Now we're off and running. Hello, everybody. We have, again, the distinguished pleasure of James Tunney as a guest. Following up from last time when we talked about the net of Scientocracy, sort of the situation which we find ourselves presently ensconced, and there was an intervening conversation with my friend Kamal Southall, which occasioned this chat today, where we might start just by recalling people as to what one intends by Scientocracy, but really what we want to, upon what we want to focus is the historical context, a sketch, as it were, is what has brought us to this current impasse, right? So, as I understand the notion of Scientocracy, what you're looking at is a situation where authority has been decentered from individuals and turned over, on one hand, to certain institutional frameworks, but also there's an underlying sort of set of ideological commitments that capture even the elite, so that even they are not necessarily acting in accord with what might be called merely human interest. But that's sort of my impression. I'll turn it over to you, James. Maybe you can recapitulate your sense of it and then your sense of some of the historical backdrop that draws us here.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Tom. Yeah, and it's interesting to carry the theme on. And I heard your conversation with Kamal, and I think it's good to have different perspectives for a bit of cross-fertilization of ideas to move this debate on and to develop the theme. So Scientocracy is often used in a positive sense, and I certainly don't use it in that context. There are people advocating for Scientocracy, this kind of benign control of people through science. It's actually more predominant than the negative one in many senses. Now, I see that the term seems to have, I can't find the exact origin, but there seems to be some use in the 1880s of the term, but I haven't tracked it down, and it may be from the British Empire in India. But my interest was spiked in this term by C.S. Lewis, who used it in Letters. So he was referring specifically to a kind of exclusivist, ideologically run mechanical system, which purported to be based on science, but obviously, or not obviously, would more than likely devolve or emerge from scientism, because even the idea that science has a total knowledge of the world is has problems in an epistemological and ontological sense. So he was concerned about this being the ultimate totalitarian system. Scientocracy, there's other terms we could use. We said technocracy, the technotronic society, the techno-scientific society. But Scientocracy is a quite good word because it indicates not just the technique and technology, which is one force, but also the purported intellectual framework of science. And of course, well, we know that the scientist was defined in 1833 by Whewell and his circle with Babbage and that. So that was a kind of split from natural philosophy. And we could take it through there, through Darwinianism, in particular through Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Henry Huxley, and his effort through the X Club, as you've talked about, we've talked about before as well, to eradicate the spirit and to concentrate on biology as a key technology. So to move from natural selection to artificial selection, suddenly, for no reason, once they'd just discovered this natural selection. And one of a key student of Huxley was H.G. Wells from 1883 to 1884. So H.G. Wells is their key player, and he studied with Huxley, and he studied biology in the Normal School of Science in Kensington, which became Imperial College. And this is not the word is important, norm and empire, Imperial College, and Imperial College still plays an important role in some of the recent held debates. Now, H.G. Wells is critical because he takes up this cudgel of creating the norm of science, and he develops it. Obviously, he becomes a popular writer, Time Machine, focusing on the machine, focusing on the application of science to the imagination and removing the spirit in many senses. and then developing a system of governance. So that's critical. So he begins to sell this a kind of utopian idea, starting off in When the Sleeper's Awake in 1899. And that was the book that caused the reaction. You had also Bellamy in the United States, but in on that side of the world, that was the book that led to books like We by Zamyatin and Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, and George Orwell. They all refer back to him as a start, and C.S. Lewis's space trilogy, and also his That Hideous Strength, refer back to H.G. Wells. And in the 1920s, I think really led by people like H.G. Wells, we have a shift. The empire realizes it can't continue in the same way. So we have a shift to what I call the empire of scientism. You can see it in a book, anticipated in a book he wrote in 1916, which was called The Elements of Reconstruction, which anticipates a kind of reconstructed world whereby the British Empire becomes the ultimate combination in conjunction with business. So although he's a socialist, he's arguing that you have to use these big trusts, these big corporations to gain power. And that's the objective. And that's taken up by people like J.D. Barnall, who is arguing for the scientific corporations taking over the world by stealth. And H.G. Wells influences that generation in the 1920s, Haldane, Barnall, Lord Birkenhead, Churchill as well, although Churchill was skeptical about, he didn't believe in government by experts. And then that movement continued during the war through Bletchley Park. It began to create the conditions for Five Eyes and that you've talked about, and the idea of the empire of the mind. So in the Ratio Club, which is an interesting word because it's kind of ratio decidendi is what happens in a case. You're looking at the things that have been decided. Ratio, we also think of rational, and we also think of rations in the Second World War and the system. The organized alternative organization of society was spurred after the Second World War as it had been after the First World War. The technocratic movement came out of understanding military supply systems in the First World War. They said, we don't have to have society as it is. We can organize in a kind of militaristic way. So the Ratio Club and the Macy discussions in America, as you've talked about with Kamal, look at cybernetics. Cybernetics is about governance. Now, so H.G. Wells had moved from this kind of ideology of a totalizing view of science to the idea that science should govern all through an elite. So this is the basic argument. So here we have the scientocracy conditions that C.S. Lewis was talking about. So H.G. Wells lays out his views in Anticipations in 1901. He lays it out in the book I've mentioned already, but then he begins to describe it in a novel, The World of William Clissold, in 1926. And then, of course, he has The Open Conspiracy, and then the new in 28, and then the New World Order lays it all out in 1940. So he lays out a totalizing system for this scientific view, this scientocracy, where science will be the only philosophy. It destroys religion, has to destroy religion, the family, the nation state. It's run by an elite group, uses violence. That's the implication from the books he talks about. And then it can conquer the other worlds. And the individual human really disappears in H.G. Wells' view. It's the human as a species that he's talking about. And although he's credited with being involved in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that's a maneuver on his part, in my view. It's not any commitment, because he doesn't have any concept of the person, as you've talked about. He doesn't have any concept of the individual underneath his system, unlike other people who criticized the idea of progress, like Edgar Allan Poe, who kind of preempted some of H.G. Wells' work. So I would argue that H.G. Wells laid out the blueprint, and that actually, although he was seen to be unsuccessful, he was criticized by Orwell in a book, in an essay called Wells, Hitler, and the World State in 1941. And Orwell said, this will lead to slave totalitarianism, which it has to do. But there was a sense that H.G. Wells was a failure, but he wasn't. I would argue that the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, all the institutions that exist on an international basis, driven in many senses by the ends of the empire in its transmutational form, represents the culmination of his dream. And the key element that people forget or ignore, because he describes himself as a socialist, and remember, he went over in 1914 to Russia, he went over in 1920, he went to 1934, he met Lenin, he met Stalin, he met Trotsky, he was quite close to all them, and he met all the corporate leaders as well. So he wanted what I call BlackRock Bolshevism. That's my term. So it's a mixture of this, the worst of capitalism with the worst of communism, because of course we have this this thing going on in Bolshevism as well, where it's excluding all other visions in its vision. And a sense that really the materialist viewpoint, it doesn't matter white cat or black cat, achieves the result. So I believe that the best description of the society that we live in now and the governance structure that's emergent, this tech-totalitarian system, which I believe we have entered, was laid out by H.G. Wells in his work. And I have lectured in international relations school, so I'm not saying that lightly or guessing or from an ill-informed context. And just to go back a little before that, so that's the sharpening of this ideological force. And it really goes back before that to earlier forms. We could go back to the Roman Empire, but we would be here too long. But if we go up through the through Venice, is very, very, very important. Through the arsenal in Venice. This is where the armament system and the assembly line system really was developed from the 1100s onwards. And Venice was critical and the Mediterranean was critical. And then we have a shift to the Atlantic. So France leads the way. So we have there is a critique of Marxism, which by people like Professor Alan MacFarlane, which says that Marx made a mistake in his analysis, historical analysis, that he didn't understand modernity, that the, now, of course, there's loads of debates about what modernity is and when it starts, but he was talking about the modernity in relation to institutions. And he traced it back to the early Norman system in the 1100s in Britain. And he said that the systems of governance that grew up then were not understood by thinkers on the continent because they come from a different legal system. And Marx didn't understand them. So they didn't understand the significance of trust system as a legal vehicle, for example, that would be the basis of colonization structures in the United States, the East India Company, and their universities were trust systems, or a different legal vehicle, which led to antitrust in the United States in the 1890s, but not on a global level. So I do think we have to go back there to the Plantagenets and the development of control by rules, and they're experts. The Normans were experts in establishing rule-based systems. They imprinted that at a top-down system on the pre-existing Anglo-Saxon legal system and the Catholic system. A lot of people don't understand the complexity of evolution of rights going back to the medieval period, but that's another story. But what we see is a growth of rule-based systems, a military-industrial complex from that period where military might, military technology and engineering gives you power. Engineering was inherently associated with military machines. And this methodology has continued right through until contemporary times. And with the expansion in the New World, the British Empire, John Dee, this kind of mystical approach to an empire, which was based on the sea, which became the basis of the control by sea routes. And then the Anglo-American sphere, shift of the military-industrial complex to places like California, a shift of military power over the Pacific. It's a continuation of this idea, which we could trace back. Well, of course, utopians go back to Plato and other people, but in the context of Scientocracy, we have to think of Bacon and the New Atlantis. So we have a link between this imperial power, colonization, plantation, and this scientific community. So these were forerunners that led through the Royal Society, through the imperial system, which it was informed by like the Dutch Empire in particular, their focus on developing markets in relation to plants, and on corresponded with the new world they were exploring, corresponded with the new internal world. One aspect of the new world was the world inside the body, which I refer to in the painting behind me, the anatomy lesson of Dr. Tulp by Rembrandt, where he's showing this going into the body. And this was the context in which Descartes came out, and associated with that was an idea of the human as merely a mechanical device. So they kind of, there's a whole range of different themes that come together. But the last point I would mention, so what is Scientocracy? I believe Scientocracy is the development of a network of control of intelligence by concentration of intelligence. So the key word is intelligence. We talked about network last week. Network is a network. Network is the word they use to describe it in the new World Health Organization treaty, the system they're setting up, their network. But it's a control system. Cybernetics, the military industrial complex, the totality is geared towards control of first experimentation in foreign populations and then application internally to one's own people. So the people that are promoting and involved in the complex will ultimately suffer under the context because it's aimed to reduce that. And we can see that in the United States, every technology they applied abroad brings some benefits to governance for the people that want to govern people more stringently at home in the United States to govern its own citizens. So the word intelligence, last point, the word intelligence is an important word. It's a critical word in relation to Scientocracy. And to explain the significance of that word, I'd refer back to the Elizabethan time where a lot of this imperial and the construct came from. And intelligence meant a number or could refer to a number of different things then and thereafter. Of course, we accept as intelligence in relation to our capacity to deal with the world, et cetera, in the normal sense, the thing that they purport to measure with intelligence, quote, whatever. And we allow all that debate. But that general sense of intelligence agency, et cetera. But intelligence also refers to the military security context. And this was a key word. And John Dee, of course, was the original 007. So that was where 007 and James Bond came from, John Dee, because these people were involved in setting up the intelligence system, as Bacon was. And link between intelligence and knowledge was very, very important. We have the intelligencers around the time of the Royal Society. That was the basis of the kind of Republic of Letters, getting intelligence, you know, for the scientific community and gathering intelligence. So it's not only a kind of state class system, gathering of intelligence, but it informs the direction of the pursuit of knowledge. But there's also the third element of intelligence, which is forgotten about. So when John Dee is trying to communicate with the angels, he's trying to communicate with angelic intelligence. So we have the intelligences in that domain. So it's not confined to any materialistic viewpoint. It's a totalizing view of intelligence. So then when you have the idea of sorcery or magic, and sorcery is a word that Norbert Wiener and Wiener, in the context of cybernetics, used to describe the misuse of cybernetics and the gadget-worshipping science. The sorcerers want to control intelligence. They want to use angelic intelligence. That's what conjuring is. That's what the founder of Mormonism was trying to do when he was doing his treasure hunting. That's what you see in the context of Scientology. A lot of the new religions in the United States were formed by people that were dealing with these intelligences or were very interested in these intelligences. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the communication with spirits, it's about dealing with intelligences. So the idea is another paradox, that the Scientocracy purports to deny the spirit, but they only want to deny the spirit in certain contexts that are inconsistent with its own pursuit of power. And at the same time, there's this strange occult or dark occult element, which can be rationalized by looking at the use of the terms or by considering the ideas of intelligence in a broader perspective. So in summary, I believe there is a particular path which can help us to understand the origin of contemporary Scientocracy if we consider this idea of a system of governance which is based on an elite who have concentrated power and concentrated intelligence in order to control mass intelligence. So that's what I think is the best sketch I can. Can't hear you.
We covered a good deal of ground
there.
So lots of things coming up.
Yeah.
So I'm only hesitating because I don't know quite where to jump next. But we could just, for one thing, let me just say that, you know, I had not really appreciated the significance of H.G. Wells. You know, I know who he is, right? Most people just think of him as a science fiction author, like Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, right? You know, in the popular imagination. So your sort of inflection as to his significance, it's almost irrelevant whether he was personally successful or unsuccessful. Clearly, he's articulating a kind of Weltanschauung worldview, which informs the spirit of the time. And it's, I think what's notable is his connection to someone like Thomas Huxley. So I think another, you hear his name, but relatively hideous figure. So that acknowledgement, you mentioned, though, it might also be interesting if you could say a little bit more about the definition of the science of the scientist, which sort of slightly predates the debate you alluded to, the debate with Babbage. Yes. And maybe you could say a little bit more about that, because.
So we're only talking about, bearing in mind, H.G. Wells is born in 1866. And the definition of a scientist, as we know it, was articulated in 1833. So it's only a short period of time, the idea. And what I see the definition of scientists as doing, it arose in the context of a debate with Coleridge, where Coleridge is wondering about, he would have seen himself as a natural philosopher, entitled to talk about these things of poetry, etc. But what was emerging through people like William Whewell and that, again, crystallographer and Babbage, was a kind of technique of governance. So Babbage is developing a system to deal with a whole lot of calculations that's necessary for the administration of a colonial system that can't be done on an individual basis. Of course, the original computers referred to people. There was a mass of people that did this computational job. So we have this transfer. But so the reasons why we have these transfers is because the imperial system needs them. It's the machine of imperial governance needs these machines to operate them. So machine is a critical thing. And the great innovation, if you like, of H.G. Wells in his work in 1895 was that time machine. Time travel was not a new idea. It's an ancient idea. But just to put in a machine, now he didn't tell us how the machine worked. It sounds like a bit of a bicycle with a few bulbs on it, but I remember. But I mean, he doesn't tell us how it works, but there's an implication that science knows better. He does reproduce the thinking, the latest thinking on the nature of time at that period, but his job was to teach and to propagandize for the kind of overriding significance of the scientific conception. But what happened there was, in 1833, was the scientists concentrated, they distilled themselves into a kind of more concentrated form by distinguishing themselves from the kind of poetic natural philosophy mode, and therefore moving away from a Goethean idea of identification with the object and of understanding and of empathy and a comprehension and all the things that Goethe was talking about, a broader idea of science. So they kind of shorn off, and science became more and more instrumental. It became purely an instrument, more and more an instrument to control nature, as part of a system of governance. So it was also very much focused on the tradition going back to Bacon and the scientific method. But again, remember, Bacon was very involved in plantation. He wrote about on plantation. He was very involved in colonialism. So the idea of this independent science that grew up is a kind of mythic. So
Bacon is also an interesting figure. Often in the discourses which I've encountered, Descartes is identified as the real villain of the piece. And certainly he has a role to play with establishing this dualism between mind and body that is sort of looming over a lot of what we're discussing here. But he's antedated by Bacon and slightly. And what's interesting about Bacon's tact is that, well, first of all, he kind of is anticipating these concerns, these bureaucratic concerns in his own approach to, you know, method with tables of induction and all that sort of thing, right? Which really don't go anywhere, amusingly enough. But he was also had this insight, if you will, as to how the scientific, what would become the scientific project, is intimately linked to a drive for power. And he was very open about that, that this is about power and domination and control. And you get some of that in Descartes, but I think that it's more explicit, instructively explicit in Bacon. The other thing about Bacon is that he saw the world as fundamentally alive as opposed to mechanical. And where that sort of dovetails with the fascination with the occult eventually and so forth, right?
But just
go on.
Come back on that. So thinking about Bacon, one must give the people credit for what they have achieved. I mean, the problem in many senses is with the people that haven't contributed any or thought about these issues. It's that we can't actually blame the agents that in some senses for doing their things. That was in their nature. They did that. We must deal with it and we must respond to it. The challenge is to us. But there's a curious thing about Bacon. Of course, there's a purported connection to the Christian context, but the structure of the scientific priesthood is, as far as I remember, predicated on a link back to Abraham. And this is a thing that's ignored by scientists. So in many senses, you could put it in the category of an Abrahamic, the Abrahamic religions. You might, if you read it closely, there's a purported connection back to Abraham and Solomon. So
Does that occur sort of like through a Gnostic line of tradition, or I'm not familiar with that?
Well, it's just referring. He does claim that it's a continuation in some way of a theological viewpoint, if you like. I mean, an Old Testament or a foundation. It's there in the book. That's not in Wells. So by the time, so here's a shift. By the time we get to Bacon, to H.G. Wells, religion has totally disappeared and religion is the enemy. So this we can't use the same accusation against Bacon, whatever big flaws he made or whatever, however wrong he was. It's a much narrower view. And I think that's right in relation to the nuances between what Descartes stood for. An interesting point about Descartes was that the famous incident when he's looking out the window and he's wondering whether people are automatons. Now, where this came from was because of his the work of the Catholic Church in developing mechanical automata. The Church, it's always ridiculed for its lack of science, but the Church was the leading force in many senses, which is constantly being ignored in the development of scientific and mechanical methods. But from the only point I would say about, but Bacon was obviously, that can be just a maneuver as well, that claim to historical or biblical base, but it certainly there is the claim back to Solomon, and you might, Solomon is critical in all this, and he still is, and Solomon's temple and the idea of wisdom, but also Solomon's engagement with the intelligences, the other intelligences beyond the world is important. So Solomon becomes...
We should probably circle back accordingly to the notion of intelligence, especially given our most recent discourses and the preoccupation with so-called artificial intelligence.
Yeah, well, the artificial bit is really a description of the application of the machine to this context and the facilitation, because in the origin of NATO, a key concept was the machine of governance, the machines needed, and it's unbelievable, Clarence Strait, the machine needs this governance system, the needs of the machine. And H.G. Wells has it in The Science of Life, this kind of propagandizing thing about totalizing educational view of science. He talks about the human is the machine, going back to Delametri, and the human is a machine. And then we have the idea, the machine to govern, which came in the 19th century. So everything is a machine, and we become assimilated in a machine. So the artificialness, which was consistent with the shift of natural selection to artificial selection, is the constant striving, as Lull would call it, for technique to control intelligence. So that's the artificiality. It's the concentration. It's the technique necessary for control. So the objective of this strand, this totalizing view, is to control human life, but most importantly, to control intelligence. And in that, the humans are a danger because they are a major source of intelligence at the moment until they penetrate into the mind, until they come into the new world of the control of consciousness. And one last point that we should mention is that H.G. Wells, I think, was inspired by a shift associated with the French Revolution. It's hard to make this out, but I think it's quite clear when you look at his work. And the Marquis de Condorcet and Henri de Saint-Simon, and that was you could regard it as a counter-revolutionary force, whereby at the time of the revolution, there's a number of forces, former aristocratic forces as well, and they're saying, well, what's the next step? And the next step is governance by the scientific elite, really a response to the French Revolution and the Enlightenment context. So there's a kind of implication of a move away from the aristocratic elite towards the scientific method or one that they can combine in, and one that business can combine in. So that French connection from the French Revolution comes in again, and that continuity is there, and the idea, and from there comes Comte and sociology, and Comte studied with Henri de Saint-Simon. So that brings us back to that period just before the definition of a scientist. So we have all this, it's a concentration, a distillation all the time in this system.
So, I mean, what you can maybe do in a moment is go, I mean, it seems like we almost have to go further back, right? Yeah. But I just wanted to say that what strikes me about this notion or our relationship with the concept of intelligence is how in present discussions, it seems treated in an incredibly hollow manner, right? Instead of something, to me, it's actually incoherent to say something like a computer program is intelligent, because from where I stand, to really be intelligent, you have to be possessed of a kind of awareness. To understand, you have to have a mind. Yes. An abacus is not intelligence. And you know, ChatGPT is really just an electron abacus. Okay. And so there is implicit in this truncated treatment of the notion of intelligence, a truncated conception of the human being, which it hollows the human being out and denies the significance of their interior life. This, in a sense, maps back onto the sort of shift to which you alluded early in modernity, where like there's the going within the body, dissection, vivisection, all that, right? The you know, What's also crucial, though, is that abstracting from the debased treatment of intelligence and recalling its original, more original sense or reference, and that it's that there really is a kind of pact in the method between those people who would serve the method and other kinds of intelligences in the world, which may not be sort of human in character. You can take very, you don't have to be, you know, literal about it. You don't have to necessarily marry yourself strictly to averring there are in fact angels and demons, though I'm perfectly comfortable doing that. But they're sorry if I'm sort of.
No, I get the point. I would agree with you. We don't have to say that they're causal, but they are definitely contiguous in a historical and phenomenological sense, but they may be causal. And even if I argue that the legal system as we know it, which was a kind of recapitulation of the lost remnants of the Romans mixing with the Norsemen, the Vikings who settled in that part of France, taking control in Britain, we see the domination of the French element and the Plantagenets, and we see figures like the Countess of Anjou, and that was
that actually was my next question, is to bring it back, if you want to sort of unfold that a little bit more. Like, the machinery feeds back to the, you know, the mechanics of empire, and then our relationship with the law and systems of law. And that sort of is originating roughly in the vicinity that you're mentioning, right? Did you want to unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah, well, I think that there is a funny thing when I looked at it in relation to engineering, military weapons, the development of military weapons, the development of a lot of military technology. A lot of it goes back to France. The most battle scenes in the world have happened in France and in history. If you look at battle scenes, it seems to be true. Continual recurrence to the control of France. It's significant and of course, a lot of the French, the kings in Norman times didn't speak English. They were French, and France was important. And the King Henry V and all these battles and Agincourt and all that, it's the attempt to reclaim control in France. And in there, we have a strange occult element, a strange, it's referred to in a number of historical contexts, a love of blood, a love of battle, a love of control, a love of, that's in it. You know, I mean, the system of law was successful because they were so brutal. Now, you might say the ends justify the means, but there seems to be other elements there, this continual fascination with an openness, if you like, to violence and to blood. And it's funny as well that the most, in an alternative esoteric context, the most, well, you might say Italy, but France is really the answer to this. The most Marian apparitions occur in France as well. And there's a kind of sense of a kind of cosmic battlefield, you know, between a dark and a life. People don't seem to connect the two, whether you want to call it an unconscious egregore or intervention from a different source, whatever your belief system. It's funny that we do have this contrast, which is ignored in the total history of France. But when you look at these figures, the pursuit of power and the execution of power, and execution being a key word, is has its particular peculiarities. And that we can see that at the time of the Reformation, the brutal pillage, the executions, etc., supposedly on theological grounds, and also a shift. There's a very important shift that happens in the Elizabethan period, the time of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, whereby they consciously replace pre-existing esoteric or spiritual power bases. Like, there's a shift from Bridget and Bride, the predominant goddess figure that's been there for a long time in pagan systems, in the Christian system. And that's shifted, the deliberate attempt to get rid of these early models. And I've talked about that more specifically in other contexts. And that's they were afraid, the Normans were afraid of these figures. They believed these figures had power, these saints had power, and the goddesses had power. It's an important thing that people don't understand. A thing that annoys me, really annoys me in relation to the discussion of these issues, is that people haven't really read history about what's getting involved, but say about the Catholic Church, because the dominant view is, oh, the Catholic Church bad, the whole thing is thrown out the window, and this is also an agenda the propaganda system sells, because that's what H.G. Wells, one of the main things was to destroy the Catholic Church. He wrote a book in 1943 which begins, "Why do we not bomb Rome?" He wanted to bomb the Vatican City, which was a neutral and independent state. That was how deep his anti-Catholicism was. He preceded Gramsci in relation to his need to get rid of the Catholic Church, because they understood that this was a potential opponent to this unrolling. That's why they were always the worst. They didn't think Protestantism was going to be able to oppose them, and they didn't think Islam would be able to oppose them. That's why the attack on Catholicism has been consistent. But in relation to the history of Catholicism, if you look at some of the historic claims about what happened, now you can say anything, which ends up the Catholic Church being bad. But there's a lot of subtlety which is lost in relation to, for example, the Templars or the Cathars. And if you go back and look, you see that in all cases, there is a structure of power which prospers, and which prospers through this, which the princes which come through the Reformation, these on earth principalities who set up orders. And in some way, you might argue that the word principality is a useful conjunction between that Ephesians, if you like, or some notions of higher principalities and what happens on the earth. But those power structures are never criticized, although they're continuous, and they're continuous to the military industrial complex that exists today. The word order, of course, reflects this left brain dominating control system, but it also refers to a group of people acting in consort. And they were developed in particular in the 1400s in France of mutual support. They worked by effectively bribing people, giving presents to people so that they would give mutual support in the future. So I believe that that idea of order, the idea of an alignment of a group of people for mutual support in times of crisis, that they can operate opportunistically or defensively without territorial basis, is an anticipation of what the new world order is, and that there is a direct historical continuity. It has been explored. I've read a good PhD on, I think it's the order of the golden tree, for example, and you see this policy being used. So all these orders survive when the church, which was actually in many times, if you go back to the time of Joan of Arc, and that we had three possible popes, it wasn't a centralized force. If we go back to the execution of Joan of Arc or the Templar, the head of the Templars, Molnay, they weren't exerting power in the particular context. So there was attributed to them, and they were brought on board. So the point, and also the Catholic Church was historically the one that had contributed towards the development of the legal system. But it's not a defense to the Catholic Church. What I'm arguing for is the need to go back and revisit the history, because there's a propagandizing going on. And one point I would say about H.G. Wells, he's out of copyright, so people can read online his work. I would urge them, if you want to understand our society now, go back and look at, the New World Order, of course, the Open Conspiracy, read about his eugenic views and anticipations, where he talks about getting rid of vulnerable people. This is not a charitable institution, this world, he says. And then look at, they say it's not his views, but if you look at the world of William Clissold, 1926, in book five, you see his description through the mind of one of the dictators, or one of the would-be leaders or thinkers, where he's talking about the need to combine big business and controllers and scientists, with socialism and of course, remember that Stalin was the great advocate of scientific socialism. This is the thing that people ignore. That connection is forgotten about. Many of the leaders in areas like crystallography, like Bernal and the people around him, were ardent, not just communists, but sometimes Stalinists, like his case. And they were involved in this idea of creating a new order as well after the war, an intense desire for order, which I sort of reflected in the crystallizing view. Sometimes a left brain, an over-concentrated on the left brain, which, as McGilchrist says, makes people blind to the right side. And you can see it if you read about the descriptions of Lenin, and if you read them about in the time in London, for example, there's always his desire for order was critical. There was a deeper kind of sense of the need for this order. Now, the last point, why was there this shift from Darwinism in a short period of time and natural selection to artificial selection? I believe a lot of it went back to the fact that the empire itself was dealing with mass immigration from Ireland, from Eastern Europe, with the Jews, that London was all of a sudden was flooded with massive amounts, hundreds of thousands of people, of migrants, associated with the various historical events which were precipitated by dynamite, if you like. And also at the same time, the British Empire was developing its communication systems, its network system. And we had diseases, for example, the biological context, you've talked about Illich. Syphilis is a thing that people forget about. It was a kind of deadly disease that Huxley would have seen in his work in the poor places in London. And this idea of, if I was in the anatomy room in London Hospital years ago, and when people see what untreated syphilis leads to, it's devastating, you know. So they had the techniques to manage it, and it was devastating. And it was also, I believe, affected the minds of the technocratic class. They saw this. It affected, you know, it certainly affected Hitler, if not directly. It affected his viewpoint, according to a number of teachers. There's a lot of people. It affected Nietzsche directly. And it was the dominant thing of a lot of the artistic community and literature. And it also affected views of the body and the frailty of the body and the disgusting nature of the body in their view when it becomes so diseased. So I really think they're talking about plasticity and a lot of the diseases affected the body in a plastic way. So I believe there's also a medical context, as well as their exposure to diseases in India. There was a drive to control diseases. There was a cholera problems in the 19th century, which informs a lot of this. So we have and the last point, you, in relation to Illich, Illich identifies the significance of the idea of life, which is a taken for granted, but it's not really, you know. There's a particular theological basis as well as that, which can't be ignored, even by, say, critics of religious institutions. And the other thing is personhood, and that's right. People forget that personhood was a long built-up assumption, foundation, that was the basis of Brentano's work and Husserl and phenomenology and that idea of William Stern and Gunther Anders. Their foundation was this idea of the person, which is attacked by this by evolution theory and by this over-concentration on views of Huxley, over-biologization of life and regarding the human as a mechanist, biological mechanism. It took away all those things. And therefore, we had this dehumanizing, dispiriting, demeaning, depersonalizing, desupernaturalizing attack ideology. And that's what it is.
I mean, so far what we've discussed are predominantly occurrences within the Western context.
Yes.
Right? Predominantly Europe and America and the Americas, right? But obviously it ramifies because of colonialism for India and Africa and so on, right? But I'm often curious as to how, and I don't know where you, this is sort of out of left field, I guess, but
yeah,
what is happening in the mind of East Asia, right?
Yeah.
In terms of these sorts of developments in China, Japan,
yeah,
you know, Cambodia and elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
What's going on there? Do you have any takes in that connection?
I do, yeah. There's a fair bit of literature on this and on the distinction, and you'll be familiar with some of the like people like Needham and all these guys writing about the difference in the scientific culture. But there's a key difference that people don't understand, and it goes back to Macfarlane's critique of Marxism from a sociological perspective in relation to misunderstanding and not understanding something. So it's not what they have, it's what they don't have or what they didn't have. So one point to make, and this is just a reference to the rational, reasonable people like Pinker. If you look at the statistics he brings forward in his Better Angels of Our Nature, which I don't agree with the, argument at all, but let's use their evidence. But if you look at their evidence, they're always going on about Europe and about the danger of the danger of the white man and all this kind of stuff. But actually, if you look at his figures, the most dangerous place to be is in Asia. There's absolutely no question about that. There are millions and millions of people killed, according to his figures. The most of them were in Asia. The major massacres gone back for hundreds of years. So the idea that there's only a concentration of violence in Europe or in America is a limited view in a historical term, in accordance with his figures. That's quite clear. I would also emphasize as well that the syphilis that we're talking about was a kind of retribution that came back from the new world with Columbus, you know. So the medical or the public health issues associated with the techniques and movement of colonial powers are important. But why did the Chinese and Indonesians not develop their own products or not develop their own systems? One of the arguments, which I think is utterly correct, is that they never had the legal vehicles that the British had. Now, you might think, a person that's not a lawyer might think, well, that doesn't sound very convincing. But when we have established an organization, and say we establish a corporation, and say there's four of us established this company. Well, we have five people. We have the company itself, which is a legal person, and people forget about that. It's not just the people. It's a separate legal creature. Yeah, it's a being which has its own, and it's an entity on its own. Like people might use or think of egregores or something, but it's a being which has existence, which will outlive them, which is a force, which can change the world. We're run by these corporate things, but people don't focus on them. So the East India Company, of course, following on from the Dutch and that, and East India Company associated with the British Empire. I mean, they were there before the imperial structures moved in. They were claimed to have run the subcontinent with 200 people. Quite incredible. This is an important point in relation to how small a control system can be. And the historians and legal historians argue successfully, I believe, that what they didn't have this corporate form in Asia that could operate and be mobile and facilitate ventures. And they didn't have the trust form. Now, people might find that difficult to understand, but really it was critical, because the creation of a corporate body, a body that could operate above the individuals and personalities, is an entity, and that entity can achieve power and become an actor. So when we're looking at countries and boundaries and people, we forget that actually there's these monsters which are roaming and determine history. So it was through the corporate mechanism that America was colonized. The Virginia companies and the various companies from London, most of them come from the city of London, which is, of course, a separate corporate entity in Britain. The city of London, people don't understand, is distinct from the whole city, including Westminster, or the square mile, is the business district, which retained its independence from before the time of the Norman invasion. They didn't disturb the privileges of the city of London. So this is, according to some people, is the longest self-governed piece of territory in the world, or consistently self-governed. And these are the ones that formed, for example, the colonization system, the plantation system in Ireland. Londonderry was a corporate venture in Northern Ireland. It was an economic commercial venture run by the City of London. So people don't understand that. They don't understand that there's these corporate mechanisms which are determining the world. And when corporations rule the world, as the book title goes, is a reflection of what Bernal told us 100 years ago. Scientific corporations would take over the world by stealth. They have done that. We're in it now. I believe that we have moved in it. The network is the system of control, and biology and public health is the mechanism to exert total control over the human individual, to take away that pesky free will thing that people have. And that's what they're going to do. So it really is that. I don't think that's speculation when you look at it in a historical term. So the short answer was, corporate form was critical in the difference. And these corporations, of course, were really pirates in many senses. Queen Elizabeth I's sea dogs were effectively pirates. They come back, and some of the ships, when they stole from the Spanish, gave more revenue than all the other revenue in the kingdom. You know, so the pirates, the sea dogs, were rewarded. And that corporate mechanism is there in all the systems. And they perfected that. Just think of it in this term. What the Normans were great at was establishing rules to control people, to control systems. And in that context, when you set a rule for a company, the trusts, for example, the trust system that grew up through the Reformation in particular, although the seeds were there beforehand in the religious organizations, These were able to operate and take advantage and serve the purposes of the crown and set up the trading links and become the great. Of course, we know that the triangle of trade was based on sugar and slaves. And they all go back to corporate form. They all go back to finance systems. In Britain, in the British Empire, in the Anglo-Saxon world, if you like, in that Anglo sphere, it goes back to that. In communication with trading systems and imperial systems in France and Germany, and in particular in Holland, because Amsterdam is another critical nodal point. And what is cybernetics? Go back to Turing's paper and in 36 and the description of it's merely taking the machine and concentrating the rule-based mechanism to make the machine work and apply it in different contexts. It's all about perfection of the rule. And think of the genius of the British ruling class for rules. People now, as we speak, are playing soccer around the world sometimes. They are adhering to the rules which were established in Britain. People are playing golf somewhere around the world, as we talk, in their head. They have a rule system which was designed by lawyers in St. Andrews a couple of hundred years ago and in Edinburgh. Think of people playing rugby. They are following the rules which were developed voluntarily in the British system. Think of people in horse races. They're usually following the rules developed by the British in the horse racing context. Tennis, the same thing. Look at the whole lot of it. Why did they gain dominance? Well, of course, they're imperial power, but because they had a genius for developing the power of rules, which was associated with legalism, was associated with a kind of a game theory element, a concentration, and is the basis of these systems that they applied in science through Babbage, through cybernetics. It's this rule system. Now, all they want is for this rule system to be inserted 100% in the human body. It's there already, as I said. If I'm out on the golf course, or someone's out on the golf course now as we speak, and they're thinking about, are they allowed to hit this ball, pick this ball? They are implying, they are adhering to a code which is inserted in them voluntarily, or they voluntarily accede to. But I mean, the genius is in the establishment of this rule, and all coding is the establishment of rules. So, I mean, they're very good at that. So this idea of the rule and the use of the rule to establish particular organizations, trusts, corporations, distinguishes the Europeans, but in particular, the Normans in the common law world and in Britain. And that's what they were brilliant at.
What really strikes me as you're talking there, and this, and then maybe one more question and we'll wrap it up, is just the inquisitorial character. You actually sort of made me think of the Grand Inquisitor from the Brothers Dostoevsky, right? This need to have a very structured account of reality. And there's this implicit rejection of the of people in that insistence on rules, right? And it would be the rejection of the sort of vision offered by, you know, early Christianity, as you see exemplified in the Grand Inquisitor. It's like, you know, people aren't deserving of a free world. That was, I guess, the question, though, then is, you know, what are we to do now, right? What is to be done to sort of, like, ironically enough, echo Lenin, right? You know, how do you, how do we say, okay, well, this is where we are. It's a bit of a pickle. How to counteract that tendency?
Yeah. The first thing is to develop a robust analysis of what the issue is and what the context is. And that requires that people do some work, study some of the philosophical background, study the historical background in particular, study the disciplinary background, read, go out and read when they have, they're doing twiddling their thumbs. H.G. Wells, I think, find it on the internet. Look what the man said about the future of your species, your life, whatever. Go and look at it. It's there. It's free if you have access to a computer. So, you know, the impediments in the past are not there. Read what he said in the New World Order, the Open Conspiracy, and what they said, and then begin to read the critics as you're presenting to us, Illich and C.S. Lewis and all those people that are there with the alternative perspectives that emphasize the spiritual. But the first thing is to get the analysis correct. Now, and in that will be seen that this viewpoint, as you said, is a challenge to the human person, and in particular, in my perspective, it's a refusal to accept the human as a spiritual being. It's a kind of left brain blindness. There may be something deeply on the spectrum about it. There may be a physiological, neurological perspective that drives this. It's not inconceivable that there's a deeper explanation for why these people needed this certainty, this desire for certainty. But then the antidote is, well, the poison, the cure comes from where the poison is in many sense, because the poison really may be a corruption of something associated with the cure. But the solution is in relation to our spiritual consciousness, that we have to defend our consciousness. I believe our consciousness is what people were talking about in terms of the totality of spirit. It's, you can say soul, if you like, whatever. And that's what unites us across all other boundaries, irrespective of the divisions and compartments they want to put us into. They want to say we have different color skin, different gender, different sexuality, different this, different that, different. And they want to separate us and set us against each other. So what we have to resist, where we resist, is on the ground of acceptance of shared consciousness with compassion and all the things that in the perennial traditions they say. The existing religions have failed to anticipate how this existential problem. So that's revealing a flaw, not in the totality, but in the manifestation, the development of these systems. It's a challenge to them. So I encourage people from different traditions to unite at a higher level. They can bring the insights from their historical perspective and unique tradition. They don't have to abandon them, but they have to recognize a zone which is above that. And that is the zone of our next spiritual evolution, that instead of the demise of humanity, that really this is the challenge, the opportunity for emerging from the chrysalis. Now, a lot of people are telling me about, for example, it's interesting that Gaia and the proponent of Gaia, people, when they're talking about Gaia, they forget to tell you that his latest book, The Man Is Dead, God Rest Him, Lovelock's book, was about the Nova scene where the cyborgs take over. That's what his scientific viewpoint is. This is what we're facing. I agree that is the position. We're moving into a situation where this de-supernaturalized view, this dispirited, demeaning view, this dehumanizing, depersonalizing viewpoint is rendering us impotent to act. We're losing our agency. So first we have to recognize our spiritual consciousness. Then we have to believe in it. And then we have to activate and apply it. And the spiritual traditions say that it's really only when you commit yourself to it that the gifts begin to emerge. There are gifts. If you want to call them powers, you can call them powers. There are spiritual gifts. The siddhis, for example, in the Indian tradition, which is a similar word to the Irish word for fairy, interestingly enough, but they emerge when you commit yourself to the path. And this is a consistent, if you like, with the hero's journey. You have to commit yourself. And the commitment comes from you believing in your spiritual consciousness and believing in the power, potential, and persistence of your spiritual consciousness, as all the traditions say. And this is more powerful in its imaginal and imaginative possibilities than these systems, unless we allow ourselves be totally immersed in an electronic straitjacket, which denies us the possibility of escaping, or unless we allow ourselves by acceding, acquiescence to the insertion of an alien intelligence in our body with chips or crystals or whatever that can remove our potential. And in that sense, that is a pact with the devil. Our acquiescence, because we will probably be presented with a choice. And that is the Faustian pact, the Mephistophelian pact. There is no going back from that if we choose that path. And we must take the consequence. One of the principles in this, the spiritual world, as far as I can see, is this kind of karmic or consequences, in the sense that what you do has consequences. And one must deal with that and take responsibility. So if we recognize our consciousness, take responsibility for our own lives and commit ourselves to a path of development, well, then we will begin to be able to recognize people at a higher level. And it's in this recognition that conviviality, the communication, the cooperation, the compassion, the escape from artificial boundaries, the escape from reduction of a person, compartmentalization, that we find the power of symbiosis that of its nature has to reject an undue control system because it's inconsistent with free will. So free will loving people of all creeds and colors have to combine around a robust analysis that helps, and it's robust because it accurately predicts what's going to happen. It can point to trends, it can anticipate trends. It means that a person is not caught in the headlights all the time and not knowing what's going on. It says, well, this is the trajectory. And on that trajectory, this chimes that this makes sense. Some of these guys are false prophets. Some of these are still working for the man. You know, we have to be learned to distinguish, to discern, but that's what the purpose of a love of wisdom is about, is to develop our tools. So we also have to move on from historical figures and make the new philosophies, make the new love of wisdom, make things that work, make things that can be used to advocate. We have to convince people. We have to be nuanced. We have to learn to make an argument. We have to understand what we're arguing about. We have to have aims and objectives and coherent analysis informed by our own particular perspectives, informed by our own stories. And we have to up our game, basically, because they've been working very, very hard for a few hundred years, and they're very good at this. And the odds are stacked against us. But as the Normans were afraid of these spiritual forces, and they are as well, there's a strange superstition about these forces. what the benign forces are telling us is that it's in our trust and commitment to the forces of good and beauty and wisdom and that give us the strength to combat these forces. So it's really a challenge about whether we enter slavery or become slaves on possibly in a more eternal way, in a more darker and deeper, difficult to get out of way, or we raise to the challenge and believe in ourselves and believe in our inherent human dignity as people, irrespective of race or anything else. So it's I don't want to sound negative about any of this, but we do have to realize the extent of the Leviathan which we are facing, the Hydra, whatever the technical the dragon, as Steiner called it, the Ahrimanic forces. They are there and they are real. But the whole point of the spiritual traditions was generally to give us power against these forces. It's the thing that's ignored when they focus on all the rule-based systems and all that. They ignore the fact that these spiritual teachers were generally claiming that they had power over dark forces. And this is the thing that's ignored in this. It's a critical thing. And that's something that we have to make use of, a divine instrument, if you like.
Right, crucially. I hesitate to say much more because of the effectiveness of what you're stating. But I just would think it needs to be emphasized how, when you put it stark, you're like, do you want to be a slave? Of course, everyone says, no, of course, I'm not going to be a slave, but there's like a seductiveness to what enslaves you that is, I think, not adequately appreciated with these forms of technology. I mean, the power of convenience. It's like there's this line, it's in The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, I'm paraphrasing it, right? Beware comfort that comes with the an iron fist and a silken glove, because we'll walk grinning at your funeral, right? You have to realize that you don't need tap and pay, all right? You don't need to put a chip in your arm so that you can use a credit card reader at the grocery store. You know, these little things are actually what collectively build up to imprison us. That's the net, right? You know, and so forth, right? You can actually stand on your own. And you know that intellectually, but even I myself, pretty ardently hostile person to these developments, can see how they sort of creep into my own mind, you know, and there's impulses and things like that. I want to check my thing. So, I mean, it seems on one level trivial, but they stand in for larger considerations. And, so I guess we have to have the courage to resist that. And even to resist it in conversation, even at the risk of looking like a bit of a madman. But it's just something you have to do, I think, to be part of like coming back to a confidence in your spiritual reality. And that is the primary reality. So
yeah, I was, as you said, as Mumford talks about technology being a great bribe, it's also a blackmail system. It's a protection racket. They say, oh, look at the argument they're making now. I've been working with AI for years. I didn't really understand it was going to be so dangerous, you know, but now because it's become so dangerous, because we've been working on it and getting paid for it, you need to give us more power to govern you. It's unbelievable. That's what the protection racket does. So it is like criminal technique, scientism, the empire of scientism. It's no different. But I mean, often, in fairness to those lesser criminals, their ambitions are not as big as these great Machiavellian forces. That's why I think there's a lot of crime programs on television to make you believe that it's the small guys that are the ones we want to. We have to fear, as they said in The Godfather, the lawyer with a suitcase can rob more money than 200, whatever it is, 200 men with guns. And in that, there is the power to say no. and the power to say, well, hold on a second, and the power of opposition. And people have forgotten about this. For example, my grandfather was involved, became a politician, but they were involved in revolutionary politics, and the land movement grew up in Mayo in the west of Ireland. And the idea of the boycott developed there in County Roscommon in the west of Ireland about a certain stage. You know, you just don't deal, you may not have to, don't deal with certain things or with people or whatever like this. But there's no techniques like that. I'm not talking about on a mass scale or whatever, but there's no idea about employing our actual human intercourse to affect these things. And that's mainly because, as well, they're making it more difficult, because like some of these figures, like Cambridge, I think one of the figures that H.G. Wells admires, these were shy figures that didn't really like dealing with people. There's a kind of that withdrawal thing. And these people run the show, will produce a world different than someone else who wants to live in the world, who wants to live in a convivial way. So we're gearing more and more to people who have a distance from these things. And if you look back at say the Buddha, but take Jesus in this context, and you say, well, what are the things that are emphasizing compassion and understanding, non-judgmentalism, etc., and the extent of the spiritual power? But there's other things like healing and touch, laying on the hands, and this connection with people. And this is a thing that's been broken down in the recent health stuff and separation of people. It's just the breaking down of human communications that would have been normal in a convivial society that would have existed in all the traditions up to very, very recently. It's compartmentalizing, isolating aspect, which is very unhealthy. So, but the power to say no is very, very powerful. And talking about non-violent, there has to be a non-violent way forward. But when you see no in somebody's eyes, when it thwarts your ability to get something, it's very, very powerful. It's opposition. They haven't seen no. The political movement, think about the Seattle movements, the anti-globalization, where did they all go? They all disappeared. All the left joined in with this movement towards the, because a lot of them are controlled. It's gone. Those things are gone. Groups did try and oppose, like the Zapatistas, genuinely in Mexico, opposing NAFTA 1992. But again, they had limited resources, but they understood what the true thing is. So we have to form connections an informal way on a spiritual level, and begin to believe that there's possibilities of this interconnection between people as a creative force, including the power to say no. You can say, you know, I thought of doing a class sometimes, just 40 ways to say no in the whole range. So people can remember the power to say no. And I remember one time when I was in an airport in London, the first time I saw this self-service thing, I was horrified, you know, it kind of shocked me. I mean, I was really, and I was expecting the other people around, you know, to be shocked as well. But like the cattle in the farm system that they're trained, or the chickens in the factory, the same systems they use. But what was interesting as well, there was a shift, and I saw this in the banking system as well years before that. There was a shift in the personnel's tone. They went from assisting you to directing you and controlling you. Over here now, over there, you did it. The attitude would change, and I was offended in the way they were addressed. I always was. When I saw this in the bank system in Scotland first, where they're wanting to change the model, you know, and so they I remember the banker coming over, going through, and asking, well, what are you doing here today, you know? And there was a little old lady, and I said, well, I could. So when the woman came to me, I said, that woman there, you know, you're getting her to explain what she's doing, getting money out, etc. So I could be a bank robber, and you're advertising or giving intelligence to her about her conduct. But it's the same thing, and the person's attitude had changed. So it's just there's loads of people participating in this system, not questioning. And they also must take responsibility for it, because it's so serious that all these death by a thousand cuts is, you know, if you're inflicting one of them, it might be the one that does it. So everyone is acquiescing in this, and everyone at this stage, when there's so much evidence, is contributing towards this straitjacketing system. You can't get away from moral responsibility. Now, you can say, well, on what basis is that moral responsibility? I would say it's on a deep universal level that really you're choosing whether you want to go into a hellish zone. And I really believe that. So it may look nice and shiny and convenient and fast and smart, but it's really the shop front of the devil in many contexts, whatever way you want to conceive that, but of this force, of this demonic force of the titans that want to control it. So at this stage anymore, as well as us, or people who are contributing to this diverse debate and the development of the discourse, as well, once you give an analysis and explain the consequences, well, then the starkness of the moral choice becomes clearer and people become more conscious of what's involved in it. Now, if they acquiesce then, well, then their moral responsibility is clearer. So really, people have to be tested. And we all have lost things, for taking positions, or people lose things, or there's an opportunity cost for taking a position or talking about these things when you could be talking about something else, or down the pub, doing nothing and having a jolly life or whatever, or hopping on the trampoline with the kids instead of talking about this stuff. There's costs to all these things, but the spiritual costs are not anything like the people who are acquiescing in the thing. And these things are real if you believe. If you don't believe in them, that's fine. But I believe the idea of haunting is there, that unfortunately we will be haunted by our acquiescence in this, and that the implication of this instrumentalized tool of technology, which is turning the human into a pure instrument, is going to affect our spiritual evolution. It's going to determine that or not. Activate our power, say no, be aware of the implications, look for alternatives, look for countermeasures, look for the weaknesses, look for ways to thwart the evolution of systems, look for alternatives, look for escapes, look for contribution to the discourse, look for the agents of these things, big and small. Look for engagement, discussion, advocacy. They're all things that we could do. You don't know who tomorrow you might meet, who you could influence in a positive way, not by banging their head off a wall, but by trying to persuade them for their own sake, for their own heart and spirit and life and existence, and their children's and grandchildren's or neighbors or friends. And the people that don't believe in those things, the psychopathic forces, we are definitely there, are very good at dividing us. They're very good at setting people against us. We have to get cleverer. We have to get smarter. We have to get more aware. We have to get more informed, more paradigmatic, more analytical, more systematic in order to combat that. Apply the learning. There's learning across. I found total quality management, for example, a very useful philosophy, a statistical-based thing that helps explain how things work sometimes. You can find answers in odd places, look in the odd places as well, and bring them into the discourse, inform, help, tweak, eradicate things that are false, eradicate wrong directions, watch for people that are trying to direct it in a wrong direction, have goodwill to people from different contexts, and form relationships, because that's the new family, that's the new cosmopolitan family that is forming of necessity. And giving us the opportunity for spiritual evolution at the same time.
Thank you very much, James. I think we'll leave it there for today anyway. So
great, thanks very much. And
thank you. And,
good luck with your ongoing conversations. And I think it's great if we can get a bit of momentum from the different speakers you have and begin to make these people normal, these people like Gunter Anders and whatever, or make Illich more known, or Jacques Ellul or Charbonneau, and bring them in into discourse so people know who they are and they know who the enemy is. Look at people like Wells, they can discuss those things, they can make references, they can use evidence, they can use good arguments, and they can present arguments and advocate in a non-violent way to persuade people that there's a better way of doing things in the future. So thanks very much, and good luck with your work, Tom.
Likewise. Have a lovely evening.
Yeah, same to you.
Ciao.